Welcome back to Gold Ribbon Conversations, the podcast created to support families fighting childhood cancer in Ireland. 6 children, adolescents and young adults are diagnosed with cancer every week in Ireland. And the Gold Ribbon, which illuminates precious light, love, courage and compassion, is a symbol of strength and solidarity for each and every one. My name is Sinead O'Moore, and it is my privilege to bring you this podcast on behalf of Childhood Cancer Ireland, a charity founded by and led by parents of children with cancer and survivors who know that one of the greatest sources of strength for this fight is conversation. Throughout this podcast, I talk to families impacted by childhood cancer, as well as the experts who care for our children's health, education and happiness. Yes, we talk about the fear and the pain, but we also talk about the hope and the friendship and the community that exists here, because you are not alone. Childhood Cancer Ireland values every single donation while on its mission to help more children, adolescents and young adults survive cancer and thrive as adults, and support all those dealing with the long-term effects of illness and trauma. Our final episode in this season, as we honour Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, is with Lucy Bray, Professor of Child Health Literacy. Childhood Cancer Ireland was first introduced to Lucy's work at the Children in Hospital Ireland annual lecture earlier this year. Lucy looks at improving the experience of children and young people having procedures. Here, we talk about the journey a patient goes on before, during, and after treatment, and she shares her expert knowledge on how we can support children throughout. Even a minor procedure can cause distress and anxiety and may not actually be minor for a child. Research tells us that children do remember. They're not too young. Experience tells us that trust is easy to lose and hard to restore. And now evidence tells us that preparation, information and communication are key to giving our children back some control over their bodies. This is a highly empathetic and supportive conversation that we hope can offer you guidance, empowerment, and education. Professor Lucy Bray, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Gold Ribbon Conversations. This is designed to support parents, designed to support anybody who is beginning cancer treatment, in the process of cancer treatment, or even on the other side of cancer treatment and now supporting their children as they look back. Mm-hmm. But your work is incredibly important and something I had not considered. I hadn't considered that this work was ongoing, that there was lessons and learns to be shared. And when Childhood Cancer Ireland brought you to me before this podcast and I started looking into your work, I just thought, wow, how grateful I feel that this work is happening for these families, for these children, for these healthcare providers, because everybody is trying their best in this. But of course, it is distressing and we do need to minimize the impact that it is having on our children. Tell me about your work and how and why you found yourself here doing this.
Okay. So I am a children's nurse by background, trained in Alder Hey Children's Hospital, worked on the surgical ward for many years, worked a little bit specialising in urology, so kind of tests and surgery that children were having there. Then was really, really fortunate to have opportunities to increasingly get involved in research. But right from the beginning, as a children's nurse and as a kind of a baby researcher, I was always really struck by how we're not always very good at asking children and young people what they think about what happens within healthcare. And as soon as you go and kind of start to look into the evidence and what's out there, it becomes really apparent that we're quite good at asking professionals what they think about what happens to children. And we're sometimes better at asking parents what happens to their children, which, of course, is really important, but not always so great about asking children and young people for various reasons, because we sometimes think that talking about things will upset them, that we obviously have a duty of care to look after their well-being. So sometimes we can be a little bit reluctant to delve into those trickier areas, I guess, those areas that we worry about what talking and thinking about this will mean to children. And so my research right from the beginning has always been looking at children and young people and how we can involve them as much in their care and what they think about their care as possible. I, as a children nurse, was involved in lots and lots of procedures with children over many, many years. And only really when I started to research within the area did it cause me to really reflect on what we were doing kind of on a day-to-day basis. I think as a busy practitioner, yes, of course, you're thinking about what you're doing. You're there absolutely for the best of the child and the family. But it's the opportunity, which is a real privilege, actually, to be able to step back and research something in depth just makes you think about things a little bit differently, I think. And so for many years, I was involved in different research projects, looking at what information children and young people want, looking at kind of observing and interviewing people, what happens in hospitals. Then my son underwent a procedure which was managed quite poorly. And really, as someone researching in this area, I felt quite disappointed that I didn't feel able to manage that better for him. And we still live with the consequences of that. And so really, as a mother and as a researcher, it became even more important for me to say, okay, so what can we do to be thinking about making this better for children and young people and for parents that are supporting them? It's really hard being a parent in that situation. And so what can we do to make that as good as possible for those children that are undergoing procedures? Some children on a daily basis, on a really frequent basis. So how can we make it better for those children the first time they step in kind of healthcare practices? How can we make that there a really good experience for them the first time, but also thinking about those children with long-term conditions that are undergoing multiple treatments and procedures? How can we make sure that that journey is causing at least harm as possible, is the best experience that we can get to those children and young people? And so really that's built over 20 years of various kind of research projects. And my title now is Professor of Health Literacy. Hadn't really heard of the term health literacy when I started along that journey. But actually, it's a really powerful way of thinking about how we, so that the whole idea about health literacy is how do we ensure that children, young people and parents around them have access to meaningful information. So how do they become empowered? How do they find out kind of what's going to happen, who they're going to be seeing, what that looks like, what their role is that? So all of this information that sometimes as health professionals and health services, we kind of take for granted. We're in it every day. We absolutely know how that works. But that's not always the case for children, young people and parents. So how can we give them information? But health literacy is quite useful because it helps us think about information on its own isn't enough. So we could have some really empowered, you know, families. But if those families then enter a system that doesn't support them to use that information, doesn't support them to have conversations around what they're wondering, what questions they have, then that's quite unhelpful. So health literacy is really great because it helps us think about how the conversations that we're having with families, how the information that we're giving families, how we can support them and how they can make a change to whatever it is that they want to improve. So how could they make a change to, in this case, I use health literacy as a way to think about how can we really empower children and young people and families so that they can make their procedural experiences better. And so it's more about kind of action and trying to actually improve things rather than just creating information. It's about what we do with that information that's really important.
What struck me most, I think, when I was discovering your work, discovering health literacy, acknowledging that this is now a studied form and how valuable and important it is because my understanding of kind of the medical side of life, whether that's cancer treatment or any illness recovery, you you enter this medicalized world with the hope of a future solution. So it's so future focused. Mm. And when you said, you know, we're really good at asking the health professionals what should happen, it's because it's like, we want this end result and we want this goal. Mm. And of course, we all share that. We all want that healthy future ahead. But talking to the patient, and in this instance, the child, brings it back to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I experience this treatment to reach that goal? And the experience of it being just as valid and just as important as the success or failure of that goal.
Mm. And I think that's really interesting today, thinking about what we even think about as a goal, what even is a positive goal. Of course, you know, the outcome of treatment, you know, we're looking for that positive outcome, absolutely. But I think that needs to sit alongside the fact that we've got a child or young person that has also had the outcome of a positive experience. Mm-hmm. So I think they should kind of run in parallel, that there shouldn't just be one outcome. We should be looking at, actually, let's be able to complete the task, complete the treatment, absolutely, but let's also not harm that child in the process. Let's make sure that they, you know, feel part of that journey, they understand what's happening as part of that journey. Obviously, it's not always as easy as that, and how we talk about things with children is so different for every single child. So what that looks like needs really careful consideration. But as a principle, let's think about the here and now. So how can we make things good for this child now, that needs a blood test, that needs an MRI, that needs a CT scan? Let's make sure that this procedure is managed well. But being mindful of that longer goal, that this child is likely to need to come for another blood test and another CT scan and another X-ray and another infusion. How can we make sure that we're not causing harm now for that next procedure? And I think sometimes, before even a child has a diagnosis of cancer, they've undergone so many treatments and procedures to get to the point of that diagnosis sometimes. And so that's why we always think about getting it right first time, because that can then shape how that child experiences all those subsequent. So it's having a short-term view of making sure that child has a positive experience while being mindful of that longer-term goal of, this may be a long journey. Let's think about how we're going to support the child and young person and the parents that are traveling that with that child in that longer term. So it's kind of having both things in our mind, that shorter term positive experience, but knowing that that will impact on the longer journey.
You have identified kind of three places on the timeline that can have an impact to minimize that distress and minimize that long-term impact, I suppose, of a negative treatment experience. That being how we prepare our child before, how we support them during, and how we reflect after and take those lessons and learns forward. And I was, and we'll talk about them all, because I think I have learned, like I gained so much simply from just going through the deck that you presented at the recent conference. But also as a parent, and putting myself in that position, I have been, even at a minimum level, the person to hold down a child to administer Calpol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you just know this is the solution, you're two, you don't get it, I know what you need. You're resisting, you're fighting, you have a temperature, we're taking this down, you don't want your medicine, but it's going in. Like, I've been that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I empathize with how difficult it is to not be that person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really tricky. There's no super simple answers about this. And I think it's not about thinking, I've been that parent who've held my child for a procedure or something. And I think sometimes that is what's needed at that time. But I think there's so many things that we can do around that to try and minimize any harm from from that. So when we've done interviews with, so we've interviewed children and young people, and we've interviewed parents and health professionals, and everyone feels uncomfortable about that. So if, you know, not necessarily in a home environment, but in a hospital environment or a healthcare environment where a procedure has been carried out on a child that is distressed and has been held, that makes everyone feel uncomfortable. The child and the young person is distressed. The parents have talked about feeling quite guilty, feeling that they've let their child down by holding them while they're distressed. Health professionals, of course, don't enter the room to conduct a procedure on a child that way. But these are really complex interactions, and it happens, and it happens quite frequently. And I think only because it sits uncomfortably with us that that has happened, it means that we don't always talk about it. And I think one of the things we're really asking health professionals and parents to do is to talk about those instances where that has happened, rather than just it get to the end of the procedure, everyone be really pleased that the blood test successfully had been taken, so we've got the two vials of blood, or we've administered the medicine, and everyone's a bit hot and sweaty. We give the child a really big hug, the child gets a sticker, and we're all just really pleased to leave the treatment room. And we don't revisit that. We don't learn from that. And so actually, as equally as important as kind of preparing and giving the child information, all the stuff that we should do before the child comes for a procedure, the stuff that happens afterwards is really important, in the fact that, are we recording in the child's notes that the child was held, that the child was held against their will whilst upset? Do we record that in the healthcare records? Often we don't. Do we ensure that that parent is okay? Does anyone check in with that parent to see if they're okay? Does anyone check in with the child to explain why that happened that way? Or do we just hope that they're two and they won't remember, because they probably will? And so actually, in having those conversations, which can feel a little bit uncomfortable, it's likely that we'll learn the next time. But without us acknowledging that actually that wasn't an ideal situation, that isn't what we would like to happen, it's more likely to happen again. So actually, that was uncomfortable. The parent feels upset. The child is distressed. What can we do differently next time? Let's document it, and let's have an open and honest conversation about, okay, that wasn't ideal. This child is likely to need something again. What do we need to do next time? Let's plan and let's think how that could have looked differently.
With the goal being to establishing that continued trust relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And trust is so important, and trust is really easily lost and very hard to regain with children and young people. And so we're getting a sense from some of the evidence that's gathering that actually, if a child has a really traumatic experience, they're less likely then to engage in kind of future healthcare. So visit the dentist, have vaccinations, and all those things that actually are sometimes not even in our minds. Of course, they're not in our minds when we're trying to get that procedure done. But actually, it's thinking about, is this the best that we can do for this child now? And if we can hold our hands up and say, we absolutely did everything that we could to support this child, and this is what happened, let's honestly document that that's what happened, and that's what the outcome was. But I suspect in some cases, we wouldn't be able to honestly hold our hands up and say, you know what, we tried absolutely everything. So when we, all the guidance talks about kind of restraint, which is holding children against their will, only being used as a last resort, I think I would probably argue respectfully that there's other things that maybe could be tried before that happens. It's not always the last resort. And it's really, really tricky within healthcare services that are really constrained. There aren't enough amazing play specialists. There aren't enough kind of resources. There's not always as much time as we would like. And so it's not straightforward. It's not about kind of blaming anyone or thinking, you know, that we've been doing, you know, kind of dreadful practice. But it is a time for us now to think about, are we actually doing the best on that occasion for this child now, but also for this child that's going to need to engage with healthcare services in the future? Are they really going to trust us if something like that has happened?
And not just engage in healthcare treatment or procedures in future, but also maintain that trusted relationship with the parent. And the role of what we can do beforehand to prepare, to inform, to talk, all of that is very much within the home setting mm-hmm. before you even arrive at the medicalized setting. So tell me about what we can do, because again, as a parent, I would fall into sometimes the incorrect trap of don't scare them, say very little about what's to come, like don't create anxiety, let's just get to the moment and try and get through it as quickly as possible. And mm-hmm. that's why I think from reading everything that was sent over in preparation for this podcast, I'm like, yeah, I need to take this on board.
Mm. And I think it's really hard. I think because when we now get to healthcare services, you often have a 4-minute appointment, a 5-minute appointment. There is no time within those appointments for health professionals to prepare, inform, build trust and rapport. Obviously, that's important to happen and will happen, but not maybe to the extent if we'd got a longer, you know, kind of longer appointments. So a lot of that does fall to parents at home. And I think it's really hard to know how to open up a conversation with a child about coming for a blood test. So actually, a lot of parents will not want to tell their children because then they're faced with a week of really difficult questions and how to respond to those. And you can see your child worrying. And so it's really difficult to make that decision at how you approach that with a child. But we do know from the evidence that's there that children generally have a much better procedure, a much better experience if they know what is happening. So we imagine as an adult, if someone put us in a car and arrived at a clinic and we were undergoing a procedure and we didn't know what it was for and we didn't know what it was and we didn't know who was there, we didn't know if you could stay with us, that would be really, really stressful. Yes, for a shorter period of time, but a higher level of stress. And then also children, every time then sometimes they get in the car, there's always that thought, maybe we're going there again because no one was honest with me last time. Mm-hmm. And so it can feel quite hard to open up those conversations at home. But generally, and parents know their child better than anyone else, you know, my two children are very different to each other. And so I would approach it quite differently, how I would kind of talk to them about it. But generally, we know that if children have an opportunity to know what's going to happen, have an opportunity to ask questions about that so that they can understand what that means to them, and have chance to prepare and think about what's going to work for them, then they likely do have a better experience. So if we imagine a parent taking a 3-year-old into hospital for an examination, even some examinations can be quite stressful for children, or an x-ray or something that's not invasive. I think sometimes we focus on the blood tests and the invasive treatments, and we forget about all those other things that children undergo that can feel quite stressful to them. So if we think about a parent taking a 3-year-old in, say, for a scan or an x-ray, if they've had that conversation, there's so many resources that are out there that can enable a child to hear the noises within a department, can get a sense of who the people are, can get a sense of mum can stay with me or dad can stay with me, or there's an adult that I trust that can be there with me. I know that's fine. I know what I'm going to be asked to do is this. And there's so much evidence now that actually children being able to practice what that will look like means that they have a much better experience, much less likely to kind of experience distress, which means that the procedure can't happen there and then. So there's so many resources that are out there that can help parents have those conversations, that can mean that they're not having to deal with difficult questions because that it's already addressed. And there's so many kind of, you know, resources that are out there to help children work through some of those thoughts and feelings.
Childhood Cancer Ireland knows that it's often only when treatment is over that parents have a chance to breathe and start to deal with what they've been through.
You may leave the experience feeling stuck in high alert mode and disconnected from your old life and relationships. Our new parent workshops will offer some practical strategies to help you find you again. There are two more workshops taking place between now and November, with refreshments and lunch provided, and we can also provide financial assistance with travel costs. To find out more about our free workshops, visit childhoodcancer.ie or find the link in our show notes. To help us to continue our services, please text GOLD to 50300 and donate €4, or visit childhoodcancer.ie for more.
You talk about information and that parents, their role really is that information filter. Mm-hmm. Explain that more to me, because I think it's anything that we can do to help empower ourselves, because in this position, when our child is undergoing any kind of treatment or assessment or is in the care of our doctors, it is so disempowering as a parent, because you really are handing over your most precious thing in the world to a team that you have no choice but to trust.
We do know from the research that if parents are informed, if parents do feel empowered, if parents can stay calm on the surface, even though your insides might be churning, if you can appear calm and regulated and okay for your child in those instances of when they're undergoing a procedure, then we know that that child is less likely to be distressed, is more likely to be calm themselves. So they will kind of co-regulate with a parent. So if they see that you're really distressed, you're really anxious, you're really worried, then immediately their flags will go up. Why is mum? This must be something shocking, because mum looks really worried. You know, mum's crying. And we've all been in situations where your insides have been churning away, but you're being, you know, you're being that calm, that sense of calm for that child. And that's not to invalidate their feelings. So it's not a case of saying everything is fine, you're okay, don't worry, don't whatever, you're fine. You know, I think sometimes as adults, we're too busy to tell children that their feelings are not valid. So if a child is upset about something that's not invasive, so they're just, someone's just giving them Calpol, we're sometimes less sympathetic with, for goodness sake, why, it's only medicine, why are you so upset? There's obviously a reason why they're upset. But if we are saying, you know, you're fine, why are you making such a fuss? For goodness sake, you know, it's only medicine. Then it kind of removes that opportunity to understand, well, why are they so upset? What is it that's making them so upset? And so parents, as an information filter, need to be in a situation where they understand enough about what's happening and they're confident in what their role is in that situation, what is going to happen to their child. And in that situation, they're likely to feel calmer, more in control of the situation. So we also know that when you feel out of control, that also increases your chance of feeling really stressed. But if you've got a sense of, and we can't control everything, nothing is that straightforward, but you've got a sense of, you roughly know what's happening, then you can share that information with your child. There you can be the filter of being able to tell your child what's happening in a way that you know that they will understand, because you know them better than anyone, you know. But absolutely, parents can be really, really important facilitators of information to their child or blockers of information to their child. And that's sometimes because they don't want to cause them anxiety. They don't know how to have those conversations. And I think sometimes as parents, when you do enter those kind of medical environments, you're right, it feels quite disempowering. Sometimes it's difficult as a parent to be able to ask the questions that you kind of want to ask, either because your child's sitting there and you don't want to ask in front of your child, or you don't want to look a nuisance. You don't want to look like the difficult parent. You don't want to look like, oh, someone's there, this is more questions. But if you don't ask, then you won't know, and that will affect your ability to support your child. So do have this important role. Sorry.
Is there should we adapt our behavior in this stage? Is it like age dependent? Like, How do we navigate that if we're talking about a 1-year-old versus a 5-year-old versus a 14-year-old?
Mm.
How do we, when do it, from your research and from your evidence, the idea of that co-regulation and the calm parent, and while, you know, we can appreciate that a 1-year-old won't understand the information, but from your research, the co-regulation begins as early as a baby is born, I assume.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, but I think it depends our role and our role in facilitating the experience of our children is dependent probably on more than just age. So we know that there's so many other factors that influence how a child will need information, respond to information, and need different kinds of support through a procedure. So age is important, but we know that children who have more experiences of healthcare services, so have had lots of procedures, have had lots of appointments, will often require different kinds of information than a child when it's their first time, because they've got all that lived experience that they're bringing with them. We also know there might be some children who might have some learning difficulties or learning disabilities, or who might be neurodiverse, who actually will require different support, or just at least for us to think about, do they require different support? What else can we do to support that child or young person? But if we think about giving information, preparing a child and supporting a child, that 1-year-old, our role as a parent becomes that person to support that little person. But we know them really well. We know that their favourite things are, I don't know, I'm a bit outdated now because my kids are older, but like Paw Patrol, or they really, really love Bluey or whatever. So we know what they love. We know what will really engage them. So as parents, can we bring those things along, because we know that that might really, really help them, either to help them have a conversation with the health professionals, because the health professionals can immediately attune themselves to, oh, this child really likes this cartoon character or is really, really interested in this. And it's a really important bridge for building that trust. We can use those kind of interests to try and help improve that child's procedure. So we can bring things with us as parents to that appointment. We can make sure that we've got a really, really good cartoon downloaded on our phones, because Wi-Fi is always awful in hospitals. Mm-hmm. So have we got something downloaded? Have we got something ready to go? Because as a parent, I've gone and had a look and I know that we're likely to be there for an hour. So a child's going to already be quite anxious and stressed if they're sitting in an environment for an hour. So what can I do to make that waiting easier? I'm going to bring stuff with me. I'm going to bring snacks if I can. I'm going to make sure that I'm there to try and, you know, support that small child having that. If we think about a 5-year-old, then we're going to immediately start to think about they're going to want to know more. Mm. So children will want to know who's going to be there. They want factual kind of information. So where am I going? Who's going to be there? Can you stay with me? What will the machine look like? So they want kind of factual information. And then as children start to get a little bit older, or even some younger children, they want to know, what will I feel? So they'll want that kind of sensory information. So what will it feel like? Will it be cold? Will it be painful? Will it be whatever, those more sensory kind of information? And then older children again start to think about, okay, so you've told me what it's going to look like. You've told me what I'm going to feel. Now I can work with you as a parent to think about how I can get through that. So what coping strategies can I use? And when we engage children and young people in those conversations, they often are really great. They'll know what will work for them. They'll know which bits they're going to need different distraction on. They'll know what particular points they're likely to be particularly worried about, or what can I do to remain calm. And so children, when you start to talk to them, they can start to plan and gain some control over, you know what, this might be unpleasant, but I can't make a choice about having the blood test or not, but I can make some choices about how I sit with mum. I can make some choices about what I bring to distract me. I can make some choices that the cream worked really well last time, so I'm going to use the cream. I can make choices in the fact that I didn't like the cream, but the spray worked for me. So there's little choices around those procedures that we can involve children in making, because it just gives them a little bit more control over what feels quite an uncontrollable situation often, where you're in a busy hospital and everything feels a little bit out of control at those times. So what little bits of control can we give back to those children, young people, and those parents who know their child better than anyone?
What is your advice when the distress does kick in? So in procedure, if a child is resisting, if they are becoming distressed, as you said, we're already in that very intimidating environment of a clinical setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's vast. It smells strange. It's dark. It's got bad lighting. It doesn't present a lot of safety and nurturing environment. So distress is there, but also there could be pain, you know, mm-hmm. and what do we do as a parent and a medical team working together? What is your advice when, unfortunately, you have done the preparation, you have done the conversations, you have supported them with their initial arrival and into the hospital and those first impressions, but distress begins and the procedure is still ongoing?
Mm-hmm. So obviously it depends. That's quite an unhelpful answer, isn't it? But it kind of depends on what the procedure is, how urgent that procedure is to be conducted there and then. And also hopefully if we've had what we talk about as a kind of a clinical pause at the beginning, if we've had a conversation about urgency, we know the child's had all the pain medicine they can have. As you say, they've had the information, the parent understands their role, they've started the procedure and the child starts to become really distressed and is no, 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 please, no, please stop. Then hopefully we've had the conversation that if that happens, that procedure will be stopped at that point. Hopefully we've had that. If not, hopefully someone in that is able to say, can we just stop and have a break and think about if there's a different way we can do this? Obviously that has to be at a safe point. So if a cannula's halfway in, it's not like all hands off, oh, let's stop, because that's not safe for that child. But actually, if that child is getting quite distressed and is asking people to stop and it's safe to stop, then we should stop. We should listen to that child and just stop and think, okay, can we think of a different way to do this? That's really hard.
And if the answer is no, there is no different way to do it,
chances are there might be a different way to do it. So there's all sorts. I'm not a pain specialist, but the pain specialist teams often have amazing skills in different ways to do things. And I think it's thinking about, it's a balancing act, and it's really hard. And we've written about kind of trying to balance these really difficult situations where professionals will often think, well, if we stop, that's just going to prolong the distress because mm-hmm. we're only going to have to start again. But if you pause and take a break and then just launch in the same way, then that probably is the case. Mm-hmm. But if you're able to stop, take a break, do something different, or think about a different way of doing it, or think about is this absolutely needed now? At this moment, is this needed now? Is there anything different we can do? Is there anything different we can do? And if absolutely everyone there can hold their hands up and say, we've done everything we can, there's nothing different we can do, then it's just minimizing the harm to that child by trying to support the parent and the child and the professional, knowing that that hasn't been what was planned to happen, and thinking about the next time. How can we do that different the next time? How can we support the child to understand about how we made those decisions to ignore them when they were asking us to stop? Can we explain to the child why we made the decision that that was the right thing to do? Can we support the parent? Can we think about a different way to do that next time? And there's so many different ways that kind of medicines and analgesia and support can be used that hopefully there would be a different way of that happening next time. But it's really hard. There is no easy answer. But I think it's just reflecting, is there a better way that we could support that child and family through that?
Are you seeing a cultural appetite amongst medical professionals for that way of thinking, for that more compassionate, more patient, more, you know, give time to pause, let's see, does it have to be done now? Because also in the back of my mind, I'm thinking it's a healthcare crisis, there isn't enough staff, it's a system, and they know that you're booked in now. This has to be done because if not, you're back on a waiting list, and it goes on and on and on. And I feel that there must, no doubt, to be a medical professional, you have the compassion in your heart and your soul, but there is a system running that requires efficiency and time, and also perhaps the nature of the illness requires, you know, to really attack this disease.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, through your work and through your interactions with educating our medical professionals on what you've learned through your research, what is the response you're getting?
So I think there feels a real, we've had evidence for so many years that this is not optimum care. And I think there is an appetite for thinking differently about what that looks like. But it's a difficult conversation to have. And I think it doesn't require just one solution. So it requires kind of like a multi-system approach. So if we think about how do we kind of prepare children, how do we empower children, how do we equip children, how do we support parents, because all of that happens before the medical professional even meets them often. So a lot of that fits there. How can, as a healthcare system, support that family to arrive at that appointment with some preparation, with really good distraction, with appropriate empowerment to know about pain medicines, so that that makes that appointment so much easier if that happens before? How do we work with healthcare organisations to understand that really matters, that that is really important? How do we start to gather evidence to make the case that, which anecdotally and through a little bit of evidence, we know that if a procedure doesn't go well here, yes, we've got all those constraints on healthcare services. So next time it's going to take much longer. And so actually, yes, we're working very much in a healthcare system that is constrained by costs and resources and time. But get it right here at the beginning, and it's more likely to take less time every time in the future. If we work out what works for children, if we work out how we can support children, then we will hopefully catch things upstream so that we're not then having to invest in more time further down because this child is resistant to come into the hospital for a procedure, or this child is so anxious they need sedating for the MRI scan, which has implications for costs and resources. But I think it's just thinking about every child as an important person. How can we do the best for that child, knowing them, what their preferences are, what their situation is, what their condition is, what their diagnosis is? Let's just think about how we can think in the short term about supporting that child's procedure, but also the longer term, knowing that it's never likely to just be one procedure.
And I assume it's a case of kind of every little helps. You know, I don't want anybody listening to feel any sense of guilt or pressure, or this is yet another thing that I'm potentially harming my child with. It's, you know, when to round off how we began, everyone is in this to get that positive health outcome. Everybody wants this child to go through what it needs to come out the other side well. Yeah. And well also means emotionally well, and not have the scars of the treatment, and to minimize that. But for anybody who's feeling like, you know, maybe 60-70% of this is out of my hands right now, we are in a position where treatment is painful, or it's making my child ill, and I don't like seeing it. It is hurting me to see it. And I have to do it. And we have to stay the course. But yes, I will try and maybe open up the information channels more. You know, like, is it a case that sometimes we have to just make balanced decisions around what we can and cannot achieve right now, and that anything to support them will actually help?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much about a balance thing, and the responsibility doesn't sit with any one person. It sits with the whole team that are looking after that child. And I would think that the responsibility for it isn't with the parent, but parents can do things. Even, you know, even saying to the team, you know, it's really hurting me watching them experience these painful procedures. Is there anything different we can do? That's an important question. The responsibility isn't to solve it, isn't to work out what that looks like, because there's professionals that is their expertise. That's part of their expertise. But saying, you know, what can I do in that situation to support my child? Is there anything that I can do to support my child through that procedure? Or my child is struggling with these procedures. Is there anything else? Is there anyone else that we can involve to reduce that? Those two questions, I think, are really important just for parents to ask as a way to open up those conversations. Because sometimes as a parent, you're the person that does all of those procedures with your child, whereas there might be different professionals coming and going. They're not doing that journey with you. And so they might not see the impact of procedures on your child. They might not know that last time they were upset. If we don't write things down, how would they know? They won't know what happened last time. So in a way, you're your child's advocate in those situations, just to be able not to solve it all, not to fix it all, not to know what to do, because how could you? But just to be able to say, is there anything different that can support them through this? Because I think they're really struggling. Is there anyone else we can involve? Those questions are just really important to ask.
And as you said, to make the child feel like they have a voice in this scenario, that they are being listened to, that they are being heard, that they're not a passive passenger in all of this, that
no,
this is happening to them for them,
mm-hmm.
but to appreciate that it is happening to them,
yeah.
and allow them the permission to be as decisive and vocal and expressive as they need to be.
Yeah. And I think it's just boundarying that with, there's so many things along that journey that the children don't have a choice over. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that there will not be choices that they can make, but there are little choices that they can make, that they can be involved in making. There are ways that the child can understand the choices that they can't have a choice in a way. Do they understand what that is? Do they feel able to ask those questions that might feel really silly? Are we working with them in a way that those children, young people, feel that they can ask questions, that they can ask something that might sound a bit weird? Are we open to be able to talk about that before and kind of after? So I think too often we hope that children will forget about it and move on, that children I think we do them a disservice when we talk about them as being resilient and just being able to get over stuff. In many cases, yes, children are amazing, but we should give them the chance to talk about things they've found challenging and recognize that they are valid feelings to have, whilst at the same time knowing that we'll be dealing with feelings that are ours to deal with as well. So it's not easy.
It's not easy, but I'm so grateful that you are dedicating your career to this work, to learning how the procedures can. And look, it's about minimizing and improving that experience for children and young people having the procedures in a way that we can just remove any amount of distress along the way. We do want our children to heal from whatever it is that they are fighting. But we also want to see them well emotionally on the other side of this. And there are, and we've spoken to wonderful experts on this podcast around that emotional support, probably after the fact, you know, when it comes to therapy and such. But how wonderful that you're doing your work to try and actually minimize it in the moment. Not to go backwards and fix, but actually look at ways that we can minimize that trauma in the moment. It's really special work. And I think that the most special work often comes from a professional skill set, but also a personal story.
Mm.
That is often what drives the best solutions in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just such a difficult area. And I think you've learned every time I sit down with a parent or talk to a child, I learn something every time, because it isn't easy and everyone's experiences are different. And I think if there was a simple solution, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, people are complex, working within complex systems, but it's always such a privilege to get the opportunity to work with parents and professionals who are, you know, going above and beyond in many cases to support these families. Such a privilege.
Thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time this morning.
That's a pleasure.
It was an absolute joy to talk to you. And as I said, I'm so grateful that there are people like you that are doing this work, because none of us know when our child may need it. So keep going and keep learning, and then keep educating us on what you've discovered.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Gold Ribbon Conversation. There are more Gold Ribbon stories written by those fighting childhood cancer on our website, childhoodcancer.ie, and you'll find a link in our show notes. If you can, we would love you to share this podcast across social media using hashtag Gold Ribbon Conversations, as it can help more families to discover this show. This podcast was produced by The Brand Story for Childhood Cancer Ireland, hosted by Sinead O'Moore, and sound production by Alan Breslin.